CRJ225, this is your podcast for week number 8. So this week, we look at sexual assault, false imprisonment, and kidnapping. And there's two parts to the assignment. On the first part, focusing on sexual assault, you're going to look at the statute, of course, but also find an example of an Illinois criminal case and one that focuses on criminal sexual assault. You're going to use Lexis, the process introduced last week, that if those of you who are in CRJ 230, you know this process well. That's going to be the expectation for the rest of the semester in this course. As I sort of alluded to, I guess, I covered in the early part of the semester, the orientation, the first few weeks. I gave you the cases initially. You now know how to summarize a case, how to break a case down. Now you're going to find your own example based on the things we're going to talk about. On unlawful restraint and kidnapping, you're going to compare and contrast based on the questions that I put in the assignment on Canvas, what those things are, and answer those questions. As a reminder, spring break occurs at the end of week 8, and so you need to post your original case summary and your statutory summary or compare contrast by Tuesday at 10 p.m. with your replies due by Thursday at 10 p.m. and then go enjoy spring break and you log back in on or before March the 18th, Monday the 18th of March. And your week 9 assignment will be open before that date. Illinois does not use the term rape. If you looked at the statute, you know this. What other states or people consider rape, state lawmakers termed criminal sexual assault. That's sometimes confusing to students because you know what the elements are for assault and what the elements are for battery, and clearly what is defined in criminal sexual assault is a battery, right? But the intent was to move away from the term of rape and lessen the stigma attached to the crime and encourage more victims to come forward and pursue the offender in court. Whether that's happened or not is up for debate. It's certainly become a better situation. Like with anything, it depends on public policy, public perceptions, and where we are as a society at the time. And when this all occurred, when we moved away from using the term rape and moved to criminal sexual assault, with that intent, you know, historically, women didn't feel empowered or equal or able to bring or pursue without being basically persecuted themselves in a lot of instances. This crime. Fortunately, as I record this today, you can see a whole lot of things that just don't make any sense where, you know, we see some of that still lingers and exists and is trying to surface again. But that was the intent. That's why we have the term. And that part of the statute can be found at 720 ILCS 5/11-120. It's a class 1 felony offense with a potential penalty of 4 to 15 years in prison. It's not probationable. It's a non-probationable felony, which means that the judge is not permitted under the law to sentence an offender to probation. It has a mandatory prison sentence of not less than 4 and with a max of 15 years in prison. It's committed when an individual commits a penetrative sexual act against another without their consent or ability to give consent. And that includes sexual acts against victims who are underage, mentally disabled, or otherwise incapable of giving consent, in addition to sexual assault through the use or threat of force. Refer back to our recently completed discussion of assault and battery. When an adult has sex with a minor, it's been commonly referred to as statutory rape, and it's considered sexual assault because the minor can't give legal consent. If you're under 18 years of age, you cannot give legal consent in any legal capacity. And those of you who have had other courses, from business law type courses where you study contracts to administrative law, civil litigation, family law, wills, trusts, and estates, any of those areas of the law, you know that that concept comes up, right? 18 is our age. Somehow magically at 18, you have the mental ability to know or have authority to act in a contractual way, and also to give consent. It's probably important to raise or discuss at this point, because some of you may be in situations or have been in situations where you either were younger than 18 involved with someone older than 18, or you are older than 18 involved with someone who is younger than 18. And all those parameters aside, it's just something to be aware of. You could be in violation of the law in this area. And it's it's something that we see come up, probably less often today, depending on circumstances, but it still comes up. And we definitely have people walking around who, they were convicted of and registered as sex offenders because they were in a relationship at 19 with a 17-year-old. And it goes both ways, male and female, either direction. And the parents of that underage person pursued it. I had one example of someone who was actually a student, came back to the college as an adult for retraining at a time when the economy wasn't so good. And they came to me at one point to get advice on how to maybe get that record expunged. And at the time, they were in fact married to the person that was the underage person in the relationship when they were convicted and had to do some prison time, and then have to walk around and always register as a sex offender, even though they're living with the person who, and consensually married to the person who was under the law, their victim. That situation, I recall, was a 19 and a 17-year-old. So just be aware, because some of you are in that age range. You calculate your own risk and deal with it as you deal with it, but that's a possibility, and you can read it and see it yourself. Sexual assault cases frequently involve incidents that occur between two people in a private setting, and for that reason, you have the opportunity for conflicting narratives, an absent witness, corroboration, or video, or something like that. It creates complications for the prosecution. Now, forensic science has increased the likelihood of conviction, as has evolving police training and changes, as I said, in public policy and perceptions and directions, if it stays that way. And we see developments of sex crimes units, the Law and Order SVU situation I often talk about. There's some television shows that I appreciate, the Law and Order series. I always appreciate that they actually track things that you read about in real cases, and then they try to come up with episodes that sort of do that. Now, that's a completely unrealistic show in the sense that investigations and all the way through the trial and the verdict wrap up in an hour, and a lot of it's way too easy, and you don't get to see a realistic view of any of it. But I also tell you to watch In the First 48, which gives you, you know, a real good idea about what occurs from investigation through interrogation through conviction or to the person going to trial. Also in a shorter format, but you actually get to be in that interview room for part of the interview and see that it is not very dramatic. As a general rule, a lot of times it's boring and it's also kind of, you know, interesting to see human nature. But today, forensic science, DNA, all that sort of thing, the availability of rape kits in hospitals, in emergency rooms, the trained personnel, if you were to go to an emergency room at one of, say, the local hospitals, there would be someone on staff, hopefully, because staffing's always an issue, right? But more likely than not, who has special training to do the medical things necessary to gather what eventually would become evidence, but at that point is, you know, medical evidence, evidence to be tested to determine what occurred from a science, forensic science perspective. Criminal sexual abuse, as opposed to assault, is a Class A misdemeanor. And criminal sexual abuse can either be, it could also be a felony, depending on the circumstances, aggravating factors. Regardless of whether the person is found guilty of the misdemeanor or felony offense, they're required to register as a sex offender. Criminal sexual abuse, you can read about that, or you should have read about it in 720 ILCS 5/11-1.50, or the document that I provided to you under modules. The statute provides that a person is guilty of a Class 4 felony where they commit sexual conduct in conjunction with either of the following: force or threat of force, or the victim was unable to understand the nature of the act or to give consent. And consent, again, giving consent isn't someone saying yes. The ability to give knowing consent is that capacity issue. So either they were over 18 and physically had capacity, or they were over 18 and they did not have the capacity to consent. If they're under 18, they can't give consent. Even if they do it, okay, physically say, they can't give consent. And that's why I go back to my examples for anyone in a relationship with somebody under the age of 18. You'll hear the term false imprisonment. False imprisonment is a civil matter, okay? If you hear that term raised, false imprisonment's a civil matter and subject to a claim for damages. The criminal version of false imprisonment is unlawful restraint. And that differs from kidnapping, and you're going to compare and contrast those things, but I'll just cover unlawful restraint found under 720 ILCS 5/10-3. A person commits unlawful restraint when he or she knowingly and without legal authority detains another person. And there's certain elements that must be presented. Detention. There must be a detention. And that's some sort of intentional detention. You cannot commit the crime of unlawful restraint by accident. You have to intend to confine somebody. But there's no requirement that the person be placed, the person confined or detained, be placed in a holding area, a secure building, or a cell. It's enough that that individual, the victim, believes that they are restrained from leaving an area for detention to occur. So it can result from verbal orders, lies, physical restraint, violence, or threat of violence. All right? It has to be unlawful. People have legal authority to detain somebody, can't be convicted of unlawful restraint. The court, however, will ultimately decide this fact. There's no minimum time element that a person has to be confined, but from a practical perspective, it's if it's for 10 seconds as opposed to 10 minutes, the 10 minutes is going to be more of a evidentiary sort of consideration as to whether or not to pursue, you know, a charge, and it's likely to be much longer than that. Consent. If the victim consents to the confinement, they can't be unlawfully confined. So in the instance of someone working security at a retailer or at the mall or whatever, and they ask someone to follow them to the security area, that's not unlawful restraint if the person accompanies them to that area. They did it voluntarily. There's the element of escape to consider. A confinement of a victim must be complete, meaning the victim must not be able to leave. For instance, a person who can leave a confined area by opening the door and walking away is not confined. However, the victim must be aware of the reasonable manner within which he or she can escape, and the victim must be capable of acting on that means of escape. If the victim believes that the violence or that violence is going to result, or if there's going to be something that happens to them if they attempt to leave the confined area, the confinement's complete because there's not an easy route of escape. Unlawful restraint is a class 4 felony. It's punishable by 1 to 3 years in prison. Depending on where we're at, there may be fines, and you may have seen in all the crimes we've talked about so far, reference to fines. Just real briefly, you're probably aware of the debate that fines in criminal cases are typically, they're not productive. It puts the person further in the hole, and a hole they can't get out of, because someone who's convicted of a crime, especially if they have to do time in jail or prison, and they have trouble getting a job, or they have trouble, you know, getting some sort of footing again, that's going to be troublesome enough for them. But if they, on top of their paying their bills and trying to feed their kids and get a job that's going to have a sustainable wage, they have to make these payments on fines. A lot of times we know, and I've led and participated in studies in this regard, we know that it's counterproductive. We know that a young male, say between the ages of 15 and 21, who commits a property crime, misdemeanor property crime, if they're diverted, if they're provided with some sort of alternate route to finish their education, get a GED or finish high school, help with employment, help to get footing and traction moving forward, that a large percentage of those individuals do not commit another crime. If they're put in jail and fined, on the other hand, they typically commit another property crime, another misdemeanor. And then eventually, if that's still the route, if they're not diverted, and that diversion is going to be a little tougher because now they have two convictions, then what we see is that they would be inclined to commit a crime on persons, a violent act on somebody more likely, which is going to then be something that takes them even further in the hole, further down a path of incarceration or whatever. So that's just the reality. And something to keep in mind when you see these penalties, and especially if there's a fine involved or potential fine. And we're sort of moving away from that. I hope we do move away from that. I can tell you that I audited in one study 10 years of Peoria County criminal misdemeanor and felony cases to determine how much in dollars was still owed in fines, and the percentage was around 90%. So in a 10-year period, 90% of fines entered against individuals who had committed misdemeanors and felonies went uncollected. makes sense. Makes logical sense. Now, kidnapping is committed in Illinois if someone knowingly confines another person against their will and moves a person. So it's sort of unlawful restraint, but you move the person. It can be from one house to the house next door. You have to move them far. It doesn't have to be across state lines. But you move the person by force or threat of force from one place to another. And it's against their will. Now, kidnapping may not always happen through some sort of physical force or obvious physical force. A person can be kidnapped through fraud or deceit or enticement, as long as the perpetrator intended to secretly confine them against their will. And we're going to know if the perpetrator, those of you who have evidence can see where I'm going to go with this, the perpetrator either tells us that that's what they intended, or the circumstantial evidence, the facts of the occurrence, what the perpetrator did that we can document either through testimony or physical evidence, indicates an intent to secretly confine the victim against their will. There's various categories of kidnapping that we see throughout the law. The Amber Alert, the parental kidnapping, where a parent who isn't supposed to have custody of that child at that time keeps custody or tries to maintain custody in violation of a court order dictating that they shall not have custody at that time. That's parental kidnapping. People kidnap acquaintances or people they know. People kidnap strangers. People kidnap for purposes of being a sexual predator and all the things we've discussed earlier. Some of you have taken the human trafficking class and you know about human trafficking. That's kidnapping. We've had categories of brides, people being kidnapped for the purpose of making them a bride, making them a marital partner. And then we have good old kidnapping for extortion or ransom, which is the one most people commonly think about outside of really the Amber Alert types and the sexual predator and human trafficking. You could argue that a lot of the human trafficking is for extortion or ransom, so to speak. Those are the topics for week 8. Remember, we have a week off for spring break. Log back in on or before the 18th so you can get back to work. And then come with the attitude of finishing up. If you haven't, for the legal studies students, gotten a hold of me, or the CRJ 911 or law enforcement students gotten a hold of Mr. Huerman, do that so you can come back and then in early April get your schedule squared away for summer and fall. If you plan to graduate and you haven't petitioned, get your petitions in. Go to your e-services, find the document, get your petitions in, or contact your advisor. But get your petitions in to graduate in May. If you only have some courses in the summer and you're going to be done after the summer, get a petition in so you can get that degree. I appreciate your efforts this first half of the semester. I look forward to seeing all you produce that second half. That second half will go quick. Enjoy your spring break. Hey, and even, I'm not going anywhere, so if you need me over the spring break, as always, you know where to find me.